From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, the 3rd of December, 2019, and welcome to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Really glad you could tune in this morning and hear what we have on tap for you. One of the things we're going to be doing later on in the show, second hour actually, is talking with the Health Commissioner, Mark Levine. He's got a new statement out yesterday about marijuana, these days more likely known as cannabis, some of the health worries about overuse of cannabis and the, especially for, this is something I'm going to be talking with him about because I wasn't familiar, but apparently there's concern, especially about pregnant women and breastfeeding moms and folks like that who probably, according to the health commissioner, should stay away from cannabis altogether. Anyway, you know, we'll be talking about that a little bit later. We're also going to get some interesting commentary, I think, from Bob Ney, our old Talk Media News friend, is going to be visiting with us today. And but first, right here in the first half hour of the program, I wanted to continue with WDEV's focus this morning on a really great program here located right here in central Vermont, and that is the Capstone Community Action Agency's Fuel Your Neighbor program. It is the it's a really key thing for helping out your neighbors. Of course, today is Giving Tuesday. This is an eight-year-old global effort to get folks to think about generosity as they are in the midst of thinking about what they're getting their own loved ones and family and et cetera, friends and everybody for the holiday gifts and so on. The a lot of folks are getting together now and saying, don't forget to give to some worthwhile fundraisers too at this time of year, because there's a lot of services out there in our communities that need help, providing help to others. And one of them certainly is the Capstone Community Action. And joining me this morning are two folks from Capstone to talk about the Fuel Your Neighbor program. And we're going to learn all about that from the executive director of Capstone, Sue Minter. Sue, thanks for coming in this morning.
Dave, great to be here. Thanks so much for having us.
And I'm going to have an easy time getting each of your name right this morning, because we also have with us Sue Rossi. So Sue Rossi is a weatherization and energy person with Capstone as well, and want to welcome you to the program as well, Sue.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And so tell me a little bit about Fuel Your Neighbor. I understand it involves not just fuel for oil tanks and so on, but also it involves food. And so tell me how this program works.
Thanks so much. Really, it is for both of those critical programs. You know, Capstone Community Action has a mission of helping people rise out of poverty. And we have a wide array of programs. But the most fundamental frontline work we do is helping people who are really in a crisis. And it can be not enough money to fill their tank and heat their homes, or to adequately put food on the table. And this campaign, Fuel Your Neighbors, is really a 100-day campaign to raise $200,000, which will go both to our food shelf in Barrie City. It's the largest food shelf in all of central Vermont. We serve close to, between the two programs, over 5,000 people with these needs, because in winter, you know, it gets more and more difficult to make ends meet, and more people are coming to our doors for help. Last year alone, with the long, cold winter we had 36% increase in people coming in the door just for our heating assistance program. So we have doubled our goal this year. And in this 100-day campaign kicking off today, our goal is to raise $200,000 to make sure throughout this winter people are warm and are not going to bed hungry. And that's where everybody can support us in this terrific work, fuelyourneighbors.org today on Giving Tuesday, the global day of giving back. Thanks so much for having us on.
Glad to do it. And Sue Rossi, talk to me a little bit about it, since you are the, what is your official title at Capstone?
I'm Energy Coordinator.
Energy Coordinator,
yes.
Okay. So you obviously are right in the thick of trying to help people who need a fuel delivery and perhaps can't pay the bill for that and that kind of thing. And I'm curious to know how many people in Vermont, well, Sue Minter, you told me a moment ago, I think that... You had a, what were the stats for last winter's fuel program?
Well, I am going to, I don't have them right in front of me, but I'm going to estimate, I believe we serve somewhere between 1,500 and 1,700 households.
Wow. Yeah. And
I can give you a little tidbit about just recently, within the last 5-week period, about 24 days, we've served 228 households already.
Wow.
With fuel, because it's getting cold.
And is that higher than normal? Because it's, I guess, a record cold November we've had.
It is. I do think it is a little higher. Like Sue said, we had a 36% increase last year. So we're seeing a winter similar to last year's already, I think.
Yeah.
We just see folks that go to bed at night worrying, how are they going to pay their heating bills? How are they going to eat? They wake up and they think of that. It's a constant stressor. So when they walk through our doors, we try to help them with something to alleviate a little bit of stress so they can go on with their lives.
And I gather you encourage people who are feeling in this kind of a situation to just, call, stop on by?
Call, stop on by, make an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
If people can't get out, if they're elderly or disabled, we can talk with them over the phone. Oftentimes we see folks that they don't know exactly what to ask for. So we talk with them, we listen to see, how can we help? How could other agencies help? So we try to deal with the immediate crisis and then help them plan for how to avoid future problems as best they can.
Do you think that the are we gaining on this problem, or is it just a constant thing that remains pretty static from year to year, or are we falling behind?
Well, we see a lot of folks just a couple of times, and they hit a bump in the road, they can move on. That's wonderful. We do have some folks where we have to provide a little longer term support.
Mm-hmm.
It varies.
I see. And what about the overall? Is there kind of, I'm sure you folks track the statistics of the services delivered by your organization. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, are we keeping your residents in your catchment area warm more consistently than we did 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
Well, what I can tell you is that the change is that more and more people are relying on the funds that we are raising today and throughout this campaign because, there are federal public dollars that go to support some families.
Mm-hmm.
But those funds are getting more and more restrictive in how they can be used and for whom they can be used. So more and more people are coming to us. I don't think we have won this battle by any means. And that has to do with, it's a complicated story. It has to do with the cost of housing. It has to do with the cost of food. It has to do with the cost of health care. And I have to tell you, I hear so many stories of people coming to us for the first time because all of a sudden their child perhaps has come down with an illness that has expensive medicine. And they're forced to choose between medicine, heat, and food, which is exactly why we combine these efforts in this campaign, Fuel Your Neighbors. It is, it's a difficult world. There's no question right now we have a stronger economy. Wall Street is doing well. But what we see is that more and more people are actually also being left behind in this economy. And that's why people come to our door. We know from recent surveys that 40% of people are $1,000 away from a crisis. Well, they meet those crises. And thankfully, organizations like Capstone and lots of different organizations are there to support those needs. So we aren't winning. More and more people needing organizations like Capstone to ensure that they are in some kind of safety net. There's a lot of vulnerable Vermonters, especially with our aging demographic. More and more older Vermonters coming to our door. They have fixed incomes, but their costs increase. And that's the difference that we can make up.
Now, V.T. Digger just had a story a couple days ago about how Vermont is relatively, compared to other states, unaffordable, especially for senior citizens here. And the real issue is housing costs, fuel costs, food costs, lots of things in our state which are essentially beyond the reach of many, many people who, you know, need these things just as a part of their daily basic lives. Is that something that makes Vermont a more difficult place, Sue Rossi, to do the kind of work you are involved in?
Well, Vermont is a kind place, and that helps us do our work.
Mm-hmm.
The folks that come to us are extremely kind. They're extremely grateful for what they get. And, you know, people come to my office and say, how are you? Mm-hmm. You know, and wow, I'm the one that's there to help. And they really feed us. There was an elderly couple that came in recently, and, you know, they had two pensions. The wife was working. This elderly man had a pension through the VA, and he got Social Security. And she was still working, and he got this horrible illness. And, you know, we can only help with these donated funds. They made just a little too much
for
the state programs. So those are the kind of households we're seeing. Doing the work in Vermont, I think we're fortunate.
What do you say to somebody who I would bet there are many, many people out there who are perhaps getting into a tough spot like that for the first time in their lives because the, you know, you have a couple, both of them have been working for 40 or 50 years now, and they are and they're getting to be too elderly to work or just have retired And it strikes me that a lot of people, especially in that age bracket, are going to be very, very proud and not at all excited about essentially, you know, they might be thinking about, oh, my word, am I going to get a handout or whatever? What do you say to somebody who has those kinds of worries?
Well, first we tell them to come and don't wait. Come sooner before you think you're really at the end of the rope. So come to us. We'll listen. And most people, if they've not been there and they're feeling proud, they'll say, the words are, I really hate coming here.
Yeah.
Because they feel they haven't fulfilled their responsibilities. And, you know, we point out all these different factors, the cost of living, the cost of their housing, the cost of food, medical. And, you know, we talk with them and we try to make them feel comfortable and give them, it's almost like we give them permission to say, you know, it's okay to ask for help. Everyone asks for it in different ways. And generally people come around. They realize that we're a place that's safe to come to and we try to meet some need. Maybe we can't do the whole fill up, but we can give enough to get them through a few weeks, and then they may come back. And we try to be welcoming and non-judgmental to really see what's going on and to ask. We ask really probing questions, and people are gracious. They answer us. They let us know what's going on, and they're very grateful.
Sue Minter, I'm wondering, you mentioned, I think, in your presentation at the top of this segment that the fundraising goal for this effort had been doubled from last year, from $100,000 to $200,000. Did you under-ask the community this year? Are we stretching this, or last year? Are we stretching this year? Or that seems like a big jump.
It is a big jump, and it's because of the need that we know we have to fill. You know, our food shelf, we don't get public assistance, and we know people need it, and more people are coming. Between the two programs, over 5,000 people received our supports for food and fuel last year. We last year actually raised our goal in the midstream, and that, if you may recall, we had a government shutdown. So because people were afraid of the loss of other federal benefits, they started coming to our doors. And we were able to exceed our original goal of 100,000, and we met a new goal of 150. So this year, knowing that last year we had a 36% increase just in assistance requests for fuel assistance, I decided to push for a higher goal because I know that Vermonters care about their neighbors. I know that the need is there. I have to tell you, I have been shocked. Next week is my one-year anniversary working as the director at Capstone Community Action, and I am so privileged to have this job, which shows me both the potential of every individual to become self-sufficient and to overcome incredible barriers that they face, but also just shocked by the level and the depth of poverty that we have right here in Central Vermont and throughout the state that I really had not confronted in the same way every day to see senior citizens. It could be last year below zero, and they're slowly walking to our door without hats, without mittens, gloves, holding each other up, coming. And I am just so glad we're there for them. And I know Vermonters care. And we do not want to have to say no to people who come to our door. You know, other years we have. And that's something, as a leader of this organization, I know people are generous. I know they care if they know about the challenge and the opportunity to help. And that's why we've increased the goals so that we can help more people in need.
One of the questions I had on the we were just talking about it on the break a little bit, and I'll ask you this, Sue Minter. How do you sort it all out? I mean, you're just an average Vermonter who wants to do something for your community, and you hear all of these pitches, and how do you? It's a little overwhelming, as we were saying, and I'm wondering how do you figure out what the priorities are and that sort of thing.
Well, it is overwhelming. And, you know, you asked about poverty. And what I can tell you is because of a shrinkage, really, in what federal assistance is, combined with the increasing cost of living. You know, it used to be enough for one person to work in a family, and now you need two working parents and often can't make ends meet. But I want people to understand that there are a range of nonprofit organizations essentially filling that void. As the government has receded in terms of addressing people's basic needs and helping them become stable citizens and economically independent. We all work as a network. I do want everyone to understand we would never compete with one another. We know what each other are doing and are on, in touch with each other in all kinds of collaborative initiatives. The Good Samaritan Haven, a fantastic partner in Central Vermont. We know that right now there are no family shelters at Capstone Community Action. We have family units. We have nine transitional crisis housing units where people can live as a family if that is the need. But we also work with Good Sam on helping to place people that come in our door in their units when that is the appropriate location. We are partners with the Vermont Food Bank. They're tremendous leaders across the state. Not only do they help us with our food shelf, but we have a community kitchen academy. We actually run a program of the Vermont Food Bank, which gets people trained, unemployed Vermonters in a 12-week course, get trained in the food industry. And then not only that, but they are every day creating ready-to-eat, healthy, nutritious meals that are given out at the food shelf. So we're employing people, getting people jobs, helping people fill their bellies with nutritious food, teaching people about food and nutrition, building community. And I think that's what I really want to emphasize, that we are this network of support for vulnerable Vermonters, and not just to support them, but to help them rise beyond poverty, and that we all work together, and that there are many, many needs out there and many ways to support worthy organizations.
So it sounds like maybe the right approach for somebody who's interested in making some year-end donations, for instance, would be to say, it's all going to a good cause, and it almost, from the donor's point of view, what is fair to say doesn't matter whether you give to the food bank or Capstone or.
Well, I think you can give to all of us.
Yeah.
What I want to say is, come visit.
I mean, that's another strategy. Maybe you say, "I've got a here's my budget for charitable giving, year-end charitable giving, right?" And it could be $30, could be $300, could be $3,000. But and so I see these three great organizations there, the Food Bank, the Capstone, and Good Sam. And I say, I'm going to split it three ways and make donations to all three.
Well, I think that's a great approach. And really, we'd love to have folks come and visit and visit our waiting room, see the folks who we are serving, both with food and nutrition and with heat and housing, and make a decision for yourself for the worthiness of those funds. We need volunteers every day at our food shelf. It is a busy place, and unfortunately, more busy than ever as winter has arrived. And, you know, people are afraid. That's also what we realize, so much stress of making ends meet and the fear that they will be cold or hungry. So you can make a difference with a donation to fuelyourneighbors.org for this campaign kickoff on the Global Day of Giving, Giving Tuesday.
All right. We have, looks like, just about a minute to go here. And Sue Rossi, I wanted you to finish up here with a quick story maybe about a client that you might have helped.
Well, the donations we receive would be this person that I'm going to describe. A young mother, about 30, works full-time, mm-hmm. has a significantly disabled young daughter who is very medically involved, so she has to have a job that is flexible enough, but that she can earn enough money. So she comes in, and she makes over $16.30 an hour. Working full-time. That's, you know, $16.30 an hour. She would be over income to get fuel assistance, and she would be over income for our state-funded crisis program. That person would be the one that could use these donations. Stories like that all the time.
Wow. Well, Sue Rossi and Sue Minter, thanks so much for coming in. Really nice chatting with you.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV-FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into our second half hour of this Tuesday morning program on the Dave Graham Show. I wanted to remind folks of our podcast. It's an excellent way to keep up, even when you can't listen, between 9 and 11 a.m. when we're live on the air here on WDEV weekday mornings. You can always check out the podcast any time of day or night. You can't call in at 3 in the morning, but because nobody will answer the phone, I don't think. But you can always listen in and find out what we've been up to here on the program. You just go to WDEVradio.com. That's the station's website. There's a link on that homepage for the Dave Graham Show. Follow that link and scroll down a bit. You'll come up with a list of our recent programs by topic and by guest. And, for instance, later today, I expect our podcast involving the two Sues, Sue Rossi and Sue Minter, who were just my guests in the first half hour of the program this morning, talking about very important annual fundraising effort by the Capstone Community Action folks. FuelYourNeighbor.org is the spot where you go. It's Giving Tuesday, folks, so get generous. This is the day. Although I personally think that the rest of the year is a darn good time to give as well. So remember that. And a lot of folks think about year-end gifts because this is the time of gift giving. But it is folks are in need 365 days a year, 366, I think, in leap years. And that's just the way the world works. So we are always in a good place if we can come up with a little bit of extra help with folks and help these organizations. Yesterday we had the Judy Joy of the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie. Today, Capstone. Tomorrow, the Vermont Food Bank. And it is that time of year, folks. So think about generosity at this important time of year. Anyway, we wanted to bring in our next guest. We're going to change it up a little bit here, talk about some national politics, I do believe. And our good friend Bob Ney is back with us. He had a little hiatus over the last several weeks, but Bob's going to be, I hope, regular caller to the Dave Graham Show.
Oh, sure.
Here, rolling into the future. Good morning, Bob.
Yes, sir. Hi, Dave.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
That is good. So the president is across the pond today, is that right?
Well, that's right. He's at the NATO summit, mm-hmm. and that's Tuesday and Wednesday. And then, of course, we know that he's made the big issue with NATO about, you know, paying up some money that he feels they owe us. And then Macron, the president of France, had made a statement basically that our president was not happy with about the fact that there's some lack of brain power, basically, at NATO, you know, of what's going on and, you know, all the issues that are out there. So we'll see what happens, but the president's going to delve into several things. Now, of course, he's proposing tariffs on France, so that's obviously why the president of France is not happy. There'll be a lot of focus on impeachment, not officially by NATO, but, you know, he'll be asked questions, obviously, by the international press.
Yeah.
And then China will come up. And then, of course, climate change, which the president has not been receptive to.
Right, right. Yeah. And speaking of impeachment, the House Judiciary Committee holds a public hearing tomorrow. Give us an update on where things stand and all of that stuff.
Well, you know, this is a different impeachment than what I lived through, in the sense that the impeachment back with Clinton when I was in Congress was, you know, hearings. The White House would interact, you know, in certain ways with the with the committee, and then, you know, they made a motion to judiciary, and the impeachment went to the House floor, and President Clinton was never convicted in the Senate, so he was impeached but not convicted.
Right.
This one is a little bit different. It went from the Intel Committee. Tonight at 6 o'clock, Dave, there'll be a report from Intel. Chairman Schiff will make up a report. The Republicans, as the minority members, will dispute that, and they'll make up their own report that basically says this was nonsense. Schiff will make up a report that says, you know, there's credible evidence here. And then judiciary is sort of, in this case, because you've got Intel starting this, then judiciary picks up where you'd normally have an impeachment, and judiciary will bring in, to begin with, Dave, they'll bring in four constitutional experts who, you know, most likely will comment on the validity and ability of impeachment and some history on impeachment, which honestly a lot of people may not care about, but there won't be the whole calling of witnesses and things that existed in the Intel Committee. They won't redo all that. They should finish, I think, mid-December. They would finish.
Wow. And so now the House Judiciary Committee is where the impeachment question usually goes and even originates. But in this case, we have had it in the Intelligence Committee. Last night, I saw Adam Schiff interviewed on one of the cable channels, and he was indicating, he, of course, is the chair of the Intelligence Committee, and he was indicating that they may not be completely done with their work, that they're leaving the door open for further testimony to that committee. How would this interplay work? I mean, if the Judiciary Committee has sort of already got it and the Intelligence Committee is still doing stuff, how would they eventually mesh all of that?
Well, it'll just eventually come to a vote. Anything that comes out of the Intel Committee will be a report, and then the Judiciary Committee will do the automatic function of the actual vote on impeachment out of the committee with recommendation to the floor of the House to impeach, and there will be the House floor vote.
Yeah.
So whatever is still left in Intel, they will definitely eventually have the formal process, you know, through the Judiciary Committee. I think that, and I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to, the Democratic side, Dave, is trying to wrap this up due to the election, because honestly, a lot of the Democratic candidates are out of the radar screen due to this impeachment.
Yeah.
But I still think technically it was an error to not have pushed the point to try to get Rudy Giuliani there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've said for a while that another strategy might have been, and maybe a better one, I don't know, you tell me what you think, but for the Democrats actually to essentially ride the White House delay tactics a little bit. You could blame the delays on the White House failing to produce Giuliani and Mulvaney and Pompeo, et cetera. And heck, I mean, you could drag this thing right out in past the primary season, really. We have a primary season that essentially goes from, you know, January to June or so. It's kind of resume the game, maybe in the summertime when you say, okay, finally, we have to acknowledge they are not going to provide us Mike Pompeo, and they're not going to give us Mick Mulvaney, et cetera. And so, but that way they could go ahead and have their primary season sort of unmolested by this stuff. And then right as the general election campaign is really heating up next summer, you'll have the conventions and so on. You could throw this impeachment monkey wrench right into the general election campaign. And it seems like you could essentially be saying, "What we have a president who's been impeached and is running for re-election," and you know the Democrats could put that question in front of the American people in about August or September, and I don't know. I mean, I think that might be a workable strategy for them. What are your thoughts?
Well, if you expound that theory to the Democratic candidates, they may send somebody in to rip out the digital wiring so you can't broadcast on your station anymore.
They want to get it over with, is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. Well, the Democratic candidates right now, they have to be having just a fit over this because of the fact that they're just off the, it's Trump in the House, you know.
Yeah.
They're just off the front pages. I had to really dig pretty deep to just find some stories on them, you know, which are there's some things going on with all of them, very interesting. But the debate almost, as you probably noticed, vanished. I mean, there wasn't any hype about the debate there. And some of the my friends said, well, I didn't even know there was a last debate. So, yeah, I think the candidates would freak out. But I do think, you know, Rudy, and I keep mentioning Rudy because he is a private citizen, doesn't have protection. The president really can't order him to stay away. Now, he would have tried to stay away. And, yeah, yes, that would have maybe taken another 60 days to dragging there through court orders. I still think it would have been worth it, personally.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, of course, the other thing with Rudy is it sounds like he may be indicted within the next several weeks or a couple of months or something.
Well, out of all of this, I mean, my assumption is the president will be impeached. There might be some no votes by the Democratic side because there's 44 seats that this isn't, you know, helpful to them. But he'll be impeached unless a bombshell happens. He won't be convicted in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think out of all of this whole thing, the guy that's in the jackpot seat legally is Rudy Giuliani. I mean, he functioned in capacities that really, I think, are going to bring up a lot of legal questions of what he was doing. And doing some of this, you know, pro bono, or if he was paid, was he paid by government money, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
I think Rudy Giuliani faces some problems.
I mean, and we keep hearing that the Southern District of New York, the office he once ran, is investigating him pretty hard and may very well come up with some criminal indictments against Rudy Giuliani.
Right.
And then you have a situation where this guy who's been a real confidant, as well as, you know, personal attorney to Donald Trump, would be possibly under the gun to testify against his client, essentially. Or how would that work?
Oh, yes. Well, it could. It could work that way. The White House, I noticed, I'm not going to say that by any stretch they're throwing him under the bus, but they started to distance themselves, you know, from certain things. You've noticed he's been quiet lately, which he should be.
Yeah.
So he might dodge this, but if the New York office goes after him, they're going to give him a lot of heartburn. Now, that could all, a lot of things, let's say the impeachment's going to end, which it will mid-December or so,
yep.
But if Giuliani is pursued by the New York state or Fed office, then that all could erupt out over the course of, you know, February, March, April, May. A lot of stuff could spill out, which will not be impeachable on the present, but might not be helpful with the, you know, 20-some percent independents that are going to make a decision on this election.
Let me ask you, Bob, tell me if I'm putting you too much on the spot here, but, you know, you're a former Republican member of Congress and somebody, you know, I found to be a valuable guest on this program, in part because you're very insightful and in part you seem to be pretty middle of the road in terms of what you're willing to talk about and say about things and so on. I have a number of friends and associates, family members even, who will say things like, this is all a bunch of junk. They're just out to get Trump, and they're going to throw anything they can think of at him, and I'm not listening to a word of it. To what, in your own mind, to what degree do you think there's been some stuff that really deserves looking into, and maybe may even deserve impeachment and removal from office?
I've been asked this question a lot, both publicly and privately by friends, and mm-hmm. I have relatives who, you know, can't stand the name Trump, and I have relatives that would, you know, crawl across glass for him.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it makes interesting Thanksgiving. And but I, if I were there and Republican, you know, a member of the House, which I was, there is no way that I could sit there and say, oh, this is just, you know. Now, there's a few things I recognize. First of all, there were some Democratic members that wanted to get the president from day one.
Yep.
And threatened impeachment from day one. Well, that doesn't mean they all did, but there were some, so that doesn't look good in itself. However, this call was unnecessary. There's a lot of questions on this call. I don't think I would vote for impeachment because there's still not the silver bullet quid pro quo where they've got the president nailed that he said, cut that aid off now until he does this. Okay, so there's not that. But I've got to tell you, I could never sit there with my constituency and say, ah, there's nothing there. This is ugly. It was unnecessary. He just had to try to cut the art of the deal himself. He should have let Giuliani run around, et cetera. And it doesn't look good. It doesn't sound good. It doesn't smell good. And the transcript itself is missing some pieces because I timed that when I was doing your show back then, Dave. I timed that, you know, reading it, and just layman me knew there was a missing 15 or 20 minutes of that thing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
No matter how you read it. So I don't think I could excuse it all, but it probably, as of right now, evidence-wise, doesn't rise to the level of impeachment of a proven exact quid pro quo. But let me tell you, it gets pretty close. And so I couldn't just say, oh, nothing to it. I would just say he made a serious mistake.
Well, what serious. About what if you add in the pretty clear findings of obstruction of justice, 10 or 11 of them by Robert Mueller in his report? What if you add in, you know, allegedly using campaign funds and being individual one in that transaction with pornography stars and so on? What if you add in all the stuff related to emoluments clause problems and so on? Does that tip it?
Well, the problem that I think that everybody has legally with looking at this whole issue is still the fact of, you know, doing one important thing. If they look at obstruction of justice, I mean, there were a lot of people that did a lot of things that weren't, you know, on the up and up at all trying to obstruct things. But the problem they've got is they don't have the president under oath. Let me give you an example. It's a whole different world, I know that. But Bill Clinton had to testify under oath. And by the way, he should never have had to have testified.
Yeah, I agree.
I will stand to this day. The presidents don't have to testify on civil and misdemeanor matters. They don't. But he did. And once he did, he purged himself. So there was direct proof of perjury. You know, that's where they had it. If Bill Clinton had just done this thing with Monica Lewinsky and lied about it all day long and then was proven to be a liar, you know what? It wouldn't have mattered. He couldn't have been impeached. It was that deposition that nailed him. So what is lacking on all of this is a deposition of the president where they get him, you know, for perjury, obstruction of justice, or something like that. And obviously, you know, from the Mueller report, nobody was able to concretely follow up on, here we go, this is how you prosecute it.
Hey, I want to retract something I just said, which was that Bill Clinton should not have testified or should not have been required to testify. I'm not sure about that. I've really got to do some hard thinking on that. I have been on a little bit of a campaign lately to really question the whole OLC memo. I mean, I think that's what really killed the Mueller report, the Office of Legal Counsel memo saying that essentially that a president is above the law. And I think the principle that no one's above the law is really such a vital principle in anything that wants to call itself a democracy.
Yeah. I understand, and yep. I just at the time I said that he should not have been compelled. The way our system works, Clinton was compelled in a civil case.
Yeah,
and I think if you look at it, I talked to a constitutional lawyer at the time that said, you know, that advised me that in a civil case, a president cannot be compelled till after he leaves. So based on that, you know, I had looked at that.
Sure. Okay. But I would say though. really what Clinton should have done is even if he goes in to testify, which I sort of, my instincts are to lean in that direction to say, yes, he has to go to the courthouse or whatever. He has to go to the deposition. He should have just sat there and said, listen, you're talking to me about what was at worst consensual behavior between two adults. I mean, yes, she's a lot younger than I am, but she is technically an adult. I'm an adult. This was consensual behavior. I am a believer enough in the right to privacy that any normal citizen should expect when engaging in consensual behavior of this kind, that I'm just not going to say. You know, I mean,
right. It was the perjury. And, you know, there's another thing, Dave. We offered him, we meaning me and six others, they were short on the votes, the Republicans. We offered the White House, if he came out and admitted that he purged himself, we would not impeach him. We offered him that.
Yeah.
And he didn't do it. And then the rest was history, you know, because once he would do that, then honestly, it didn't rise to the level of impeachment because he was admitting perjury and would deal the consequences under our system after he left.
Yeah. All right. Well, Bob Ney, I'm going to let you go because I've kept you longer than I think we agreed
to.
But I really appreciate you. It's great talking with you. And I'm gonna invite some callers and or listeners in to call and just remark on what you've been saying. I bet we'll get some stuff here. But I appreciate it. Let's talk again soon.
All right. Thank you.
All righty. I got a few minutes to take some phone calls from folks out there. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255. And if you can't get in the next 5 minutes, I think we're going to have another stretch of phone calls available to listeners in the last half hour, say 10:30 to 11-ish time frame. In that first half hour of the next of the second hour of the program today, we're going to be hearing from Health Commissioner Mark Levine about marijuana and what people ought to be thinking about marijuana now that it's legal in Vermont to possess up to an ounce of it for folks over 21. And what does that mean for your own consumption and your own thinking about your health, et cetera? So should be an interesting conversation there. Let's go to Paul from Moncton, and he's on the line. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dave. Hey, quickly, a couple of points to make. One on the impeachment process here, and then another about the day of giving. As far as I'm concerned, in terms of the impeachment moving forward, as you mentioned, maybe towards the actual election, I think one of the fears that Democrats has is the engaging of the Republicans and the Trump supporters, because, you know, Donald Trump is going to get up on his bullet pulpit and say they're trying to swing the election by holding it this close to the election. I think that's a fear, and it's a legitimate one. Even though it may also energize the Democratic base, I think they're afraid of what it would do to the Republican base or conservative base that supports them.
All right. Do you want me to take that one first?
Yeah, and then I'll talk about the day of giving.
Sure. I think that whatever complaints Trump has about timing issues right now, really kind of fall on deaf ears, because, you know, the Democrats have been after him for months to produce documents, just for one example. And if they end up taking a long time to get this done, they can always point to the fact that he has done very poorly about producing documents for this process. And the same is true of witnesses. I mean, if the Democrats should say to him, we don't want to have this thing drag into next August, you know, and they can be wink, wink all they want, if you ask me, but they can say, we don't want to have this thing still going on next summer. You know, send us Giuliani and Pompeo and Mulvaney right now. Let's do it. Let's get it. If you want to get it over with, let's get it over with. If you want to mess around, we'll mess around, you know, up until the very last moment here.
Yes, I understand that. But you're talking to me and some of the other people who would agree with you, and I understand what you're saying. Remember, the Trump supporters aren't going to look that or think that way. Their support is unwavering, and it may engage a few of them who don't want to get involved or even vote at that point. It may pull them forward, you know, listening to Donald Trump claim that it is a collusion against him in terms of the election. That's my thought. I mean, it may not be right. But okay, then day of giving. One organization that hadn't been talked about, and I want to bring them to the forefront here, is one that's close to my heart because my wife and I have been giving to them for some time, based upon one of your predecessors, and that was Mark Johnson had, I think his name is Mark Redmond from Spectrum Youth Services.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fantastic organization that deals mostly with the young youth in the state who are indigent, you know, most because of factors outside their control. You know,
yeah.
Kicked out of the home at age 18. could be health issues, addictions, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Most of these kids didn't wish to have this type of lifestyle where they're on the streets alone. So my wife and I started giving based upon that conversation from Mark Johnson with Mark Redman. And even to the fact that even though we're giving a check, my wife is headed up there because as most couples, we tend to acquire things, way too many things. And
yeah.
We did some cleaning, went through, and we actually found about a dozen coats, winter coats, are all in fantastic shape, but we just don't wear anymore. So my wife's walking up there later this week to drop those off as a, you know, to help out to do it. Okay, that's it.
Hey, Paul, well, thank you very much. That's a great suggestion. Spectrum Youth Service is also a very, very top-notch organization. So there's another contender, folks. Hey, thanks a lot. We're going to go to a top of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show. We'll be back afterward and talking to Health Commissioner Mark Levine. Stay with us, folks.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, heading into our second hour of Tuesday morning's program here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we are expecting to hear, I believe, shortly from the Health Commissioner, Dr. Mark Levine. He came out with an interesting statement yesterday, essentially talking about a new health department information campaign called Let's Talk Cannabis. Cannabis is the current term folks are using. It seems to be the preferred term as opposed to marijuana. Which is what I think a lot of people grew up understanding and hearing about the name of a particular drug that some folks like to smoke. These days, there's a lot of vaping going on. There's some concerns there. And we are going to be talking about different uses of the sort of cannabis, the THC-containing cannabis that gets people high, with Dr. Mark Levine. I believe he just joined us on the line this morning. And Dr. Levine, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Thanks for calling in this morning. I was just mentioning you came out with a statement yesterday announcing a new public information campaign by the Vermont Department of Health. And why don't you tell us all about it?
Sure. We wanted to create this campaign for several audiences, youth, adults, people who are pregnant or considering pregnancy, people mm-hmm. who are breastfeeding, as well as people who are parents or healthcare providers. Because the legal landscape around possession has changed in Vermont, mm-hmm. and it's important that our citizens be aware of how cannabis, or for that matter, any drug use, can affect their body and their thinking. We wanted to give them credible information, tips, and resources that they could use.
And so you have a new website up that where this information is available to anybody who wants to log on and just check it out and maybe follow. You mentioned several different sort of demographics almost. Obviously, a pregnant woman is going to be in a different category from, say, a teenage male or a 65-year-old grandparent trying to advise his or her grandchildren about marijuana, cannabis use and that sort of thing. So tell us about...
Precisely. It's called Let's Talk Cannabis.
Yep.
And you can find it on our healthvermont.gov website.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also find on there our health impact assessment, which we did several years ago when we were trying to inform the state as well as the legislature about the impacts of cannabis while they were contemplating the law that we now have that legalized it.
Yeah, and I thought it was ironic a little bit that we started out the press release yesterday talking about how Vermont is known as one of the healthiest states in the country, also has one of the highest incidents of cannabis use, and the snarky wise guy in me stepped up and wanted to say, well, is there a connection?
And we deny any correlation between the two.
Okay. I've seen that in the past, and there are various other categories where Vermont seems to top the charts, and people have speculated about whether there are any connections between, one actually is a lack of religiosity. Not many people in Vermont, relative to other places around the country, go to church, or synagogue or whatever. I don't know whether there's any connection between that and any other category people measure like this. Either, but I think one of the things that those sort of two very broad and likely unconnected statistical facts that Vermont is one of the healthiest states in the country, and it's also one of the highest in cannabis use, it does sort of say to me that maybe a lot of the really fearful stuff that used to be put out by federal, especially anti-drug propagandists and so on, might have been overdone. What do you think? Was it?
Programs like Just Say No and the DARE program, mm-hmm. that were used for school-age kids, elementary yep. school and middle school kids, those were proven to be ineffective and not an evidence-based way of promoting the healthy behaviors that we'd like to see in kids. So those aren't done anymore. And I agree that sort of scare tactic messages generally are going to be ineffective and may be counterproductive and cause the opposite effect. However, when you have credible information, and as we term it in public health, evidence-based information, where there are studies that demonstrate not just an association between two things, but actually more of a cause and effect relationship, we really want to promote people's understanding of that so they can be more informed if they decide to use substances, whether they be tobacco, alcohol, cannabis, or what have you.
Yeah, it strikes me that one thing I've told family members and friends and just folks when I talk about this stuff with them in my sort of advice giving mode, if not that I'm any kind of a professional drug counselor or anything, but I sort of urge moderation in all things. I think it's something that's been urged at least since Aristotle, right? And if you're gonna smoke marijuana or cannabis, probably best. I mean, I've known people, just friends and whatever, who were heavy users. I mean, I had a good friend who would get up at 5:30 every morning, and the first thing he would do is smoke a bowl. And I would talk to him about it and say, I think you're overdoing it, my friend. You know, I don't think that's really good for you, and it's not helping you with your overall day-to-day existence. And he insisted it was, and that he kept doing it right up until he passed away. And let me ask you, is that a message of the health department? I mean, do you urge people, if you just ran into somebody who says to you, I'm 40 years old, I've never tried cannabis, it's legal now, I think I'm going to try it, would you say good idea or would you say bad idea?
I would say to be careful.
Uh-huh.
Because when you're looking at the good idea part of what you're asking, you'd be looking at what has cannabis been shown to be good for.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very, very limited studies in cannabis because of federal laws against it. And so not a lot of research has been done, though more is being done in recent years. But there's really, very little conclusive evidence about therapeutic effects of cannabis. So we know that it can work in chronic pain in adults to some degree. We know it can work for nausea and vomiting in people who are on chemotherapy. We know that people who have neurologic diseases like multiple sclerosis and have muscle problems related to that can have less spasticity in their muscles. But beyond that, there's not a lengthy list of things that cannabis is good for. And so a lot of what our website does, justifiably, is try to show people where we are quite convinced that it can be harmful so that the wrong audiences don't begin to use it.
Yeah, let me press you on this a little bit, Dr. Levine, though, if I could, because I tell you, in my experience, I have used cannabis sometimes in my life, and I have many, many friends and others I know who have done the same, and I think that the key upside, which should not be ignored, is that it's pleasant. You get a little buzz. You sort of, you know, I've heard people say you can kind of explore parts of your mind that maybe are not normally open to you on a daily basis. Get a little deeper into your meditation or calling forth your poetic muse or whatever. And all of this stuff is kind of very unofficial. It will never matter to, you know, an outfit like the FDA, certainly not the DEA, and probably not a state health department either. But people smoke because they like it, don't they?
Absolutely. That they will use any substance because they like it.
And I mean, alcohol is the same way.
The trick is trying to find that sweet spot where there's moderation and not danger of developing an addictive problem or adverse health or mental health outcomes from it. And that's very challenging. And one of the things our website really pays a lot of attention to now is the potency of what's out there now compared to even a decade ago or more.
Yeah.
Because the potency has increased at least triple. And if you go to dispensaries, you might get even quadruple or higher the potency than was ever available in people's past experiences. So one has to exercise a great deal of care if one's going to use the current cannabis, just realizing that it is more potent, it will have a more rapid effect, and repetitive use may in fact be more dangerous than it might have been 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There are more ways to take it. So you can, you know, use edibles and tinctures and things that you may not have a lot of experience with and that have a delayed onset of effect. So one has to exercise great care and using it through those routes, because you may say, oh, I didn't feel much. I might as well have some more.
Yeah.
But only because you didn't wait long enough to see if the effect began.
You know, you raise a really good point about potency, because, I mean, that's something that I think anybody familiar with this stuff has seen over the years. And I almost think, in fact, I have one good friend who says he would like to consume cannabis occasionally, but he doesn't like the fact that it's super strong these days. He says, you know, I take one hit and I'm blasted. You know, it used to be I could smoke, you know, a joint and I'd be nice and mellow for the evening. You know, he's referring now like back to the 70s or whatever, early 80s maybe. And so it's just because it's so intense that it's less fun than it used to be, or less of that kind of mild high that people used to associate with it.
And people will have to realize that's pervading our society now, whether it's cannabis and the increase in potency, whether it's beer. And the fact that a lot of the newer beers have much higher alcohol content than what people were accustomed to, you know, 10 years ago, or any other type of drug, you have to know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I mean, people understand the difference between, you know, beer and whiskey, just for one example. Nobody drinks the volume, or you hope nobody drinks the volume of whiskey that a lot of people do of beer. I mean, I've never seen anybody sit down with a 12-ounce bottle of whiskey and just down it at a sitting. But I guess I actually think that if I were an entrepreneur in the cannabis industry and, you know, deciding to ride this wave of legalization and think about this as a business, I would try to come up with some milder strains you know, you could have put out an ad saying this is your grandpa's weed, you know, or something like
right,
you know, right. And I think that would actually have a lot of appeal out there, because people do tell me all the time they don't like having this experience of taking one hit off a pipe and feeling like, you know, they're completely blasted, and so I think the marijuana industry, frankly, would be doing itself a favor just in terms of marketability and so on if it started to come out with some milder strains and advertise them that way. You know, looking for that.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. You're counter to what's actually happening, but
yeah, Yeah,
that's true. And you know, and the same thing is happening with vaping.
Yeah.
And the nicotine content of what, especially our adolescents are vaping, is so much more than a traditional cigarette. So we're seeing it across substances as part of what's going on in society. Since I brought up the word vaping, if I could make a quick public health message.
Yes.
You know, everyone's focused on the vaping epidemic in youth in general, which we are very focused on, laser focused on at the health department. But the other epidemic is, of course, the severe lung disease called EVALI, e-cigarette and vaping associated lung injury, where, you know, the CDC has found over 2,000 cases around the country, three of which were in Vermont, and close to 50 deaths now. And I just wanted to mention that the deaths are almost exclusively, not 100%, but almost exclusively in individuals who said that they were vaping THC, the active ingredient in cannabis, and often the THC was in a very oily-based fluid that had vitamin E acetate in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to again take the chance to the opportunity to warn Vermonters that, you know, if they are engaged in vaping, do not vape anything with THC. Preferably don't vape at all, because that's what's been associated with the highest risk right now around the country.
So if you want to use cannabis, are you advising that people go back to the old style of, you know, joints and pipes and water pipes and that stuff?
Well, I would hate to do that as well, because one of the things that's been shown somewhat substantially in the literature is that there's an association statistically between smoking cannabis and having more respiratory symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not necessarily developing lung cancer like with tobacco, but developing a worsening of things like chronic bronchitis, and airway function not being as good. So again, you know, smoking substances like this, it's not necessarily safe.
Edibles
nor,
better?
As I mentioned, is eating.
Yeah. I mean, let me put it to you this way again. You want a cannabis high. You know, you want to get high on cannabis, and you know, you remember you maybe you last did it some years ago or whatever, and you say, "Boy, I'd like to try a little marijuana." And vaping. Somebody says you want to vape, and you might say no, because there's all this news out there about these lung injuries that people are getting. You know, do you want to smoke a joint? Well, I already have chronic bronchitis, so I'm going to be slow to try that. In that case, would you recommend that the person think about brownies or something?
Well, you're putting a health commissioner in a tough position.
I know.
To recommend.
That's what we do in the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. Not that I wanted you to recommend, but you know, we're talking about harm reduction here, right? I mean, we're talking about
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, right. So of the three, vaping, smoking, or edibles, you know, if somebody says I'm going to do one of these. And I'm not going to say which would you recommend. I guess I would say which would you consider least harmful?
Yeah, I would consider definitely not taking up the vaping and using another method of your choice. And again, getting with your first message earlier on in moderation.
Yeah, I mean, that is a key thing. I agree with you there. I mean, I've known people who smoke or use marijuana, use cannabis at sort of different levels of intensity, and those who do it every day are tended to have problems. Those who did it occasionally on a Friday night, they, you know, at the end of a long work week, they want to. And I always tell, you know, I would tell my kids this. I have two sons, and I would say, never drive while you're high. But if you want to, you know, smoke a bowl and listen to a, you know, music on a Friday night and then just go to bed after a while, you know, I can't really tell you that's going to be the end of the world. So that's kind of, I mean, that's sort of my take on it. I think that, the just say no thing clearly didn't work because not everybody's saying no. And I think that Daily use, though, is probably not a good idea. And as you put it, especially of this much more powerful stuff that's out there, it's just that's gonna lead you to that can very easily cause problems, including cases of mental illness, right?
Right, and there is a disorder that is called cannabis use disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And so you mentioned that you would advise not to use daily. And there's great evidence that the more increases in use frequency of cannabis can progress to developing that kind of a disorder, just like any other substance that one might take in.
Yeah.
The same thing. And there's greater evidence of mental health issues arising from greater use as well.
I would imagine there is a, I don't know what the official term is, but there's got to be a factor when you're studying drug addiction of kind of addictive quality or whatever. And so, I've known people who have drinking problems who would be much more in a hard place if it were, if they'd had drinks on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Now it's Thursday, and they're like all out of their favorite liquor or whatever. And they're going to have a dry Thursday. That's actually harder, from people I've known and just general experience of that I've watched over time, than smoking marijuana a few days in a row on vacation or something, and then coming back and you're back in the workplace and you're back to maybe a weekly instead of daily use or something. Do you follow what I mean? In other words, is there a greater tendency for alcohol or other drugs to be demanding more use just because of their kind of pharmacological effects than with marijuana, or are they all pretty much equal?
No, I would really not try to rate one over another, because they're impacting independently certain parts of the brain, but they're also impacting similar parts of the brain quite often. And human beings do things that create pleasure sensations and mm-hmm. and do away with distressing sensations. So that's pretty constant among any type of substance that one might use.
Yeah, I suppose you do get to a place where the absence of the substance can be perceived as distressing, right?
Absolutely.
Somebody who's heading for addiction.
Becoming addicted to something, especially.
Yeah, that's the area that I'm sort of trying to parse out, but you say it's a fool's errand, I guess, to try to compare marijuana's tendency to be a drug like that versus alcohol or heroin or any of the others.
Exactly.
Okay.
And for some people, it's not a drug. It may be something like gambling. There are lots of things that trigger parts of our brain in similar ways, especially if you're in a susceptible state.
Yeah, these are all tough things. I mean, the weird thing is that I don't think we're ever going to, even if we wanted to go back to the idea of, say, prohibition with alcohol or the Just Say No campaign, we can't really eradicate this stuff from our society either, can we?
No. But we can certainly try to raise our youth in environments where there are other choices.
Yeah.
And that's a big focus of what we're trying to do right now, and what has been proven across the world and across the country to be effective, which is taking adolescents and making sure that they have something to do in that after-school time period from 3 to 6 p.m., which can be a very dangerous time for adolescents. So we had people here from Iceland talking about the Icelandic model. We had people from other European countries, and we've had experiences within our own state where we've shown dramatic decreases in youth use of tobacco, alcohol, and cannabis over a decade in time, just because we focused more on that after-school time period, allowing youth to feel like they're accomplishing something in their life and getting good at something, whether it be a sport or a non-sport activity, and allowing youth to feel connected to one another, connected to their communities, and having their parents be invested in that connectivity and their communities be activated by wanting to have their youth grow up in a very wholesome way. And these kind of prevention programs are quite effective and take, you know, substance use disorder rates that could be in the 20-30% range for youth and reduce them down to single digits over short time periods.
Well, that certainly sounds worthwhile. And I know Iceland has been a pioneer in this stuff and has had great effect, right?
It's had dramatic effect.
Yeah. That
it's a model that we can reproduce here, mm-hmm. give it a different name, because these are all prevention frameworks that the public health community knows well and that have strong evidence behind them. And, you know, it's parents being interested and involved, it's communities being activated, and it's the youth themselves having a strong voice. So not only do the youth get surveyed about what they're doing or not doing in their lives in regards to substances and other things, but they have a voice in what they would like to be doing during those time periods and what should be offered to them and how they can be involved.
Yeah, I find a lot of this, the youth behavior stuff, really fascinating, as in, you know, why was vaping all of a sudden perceived as cool, you know? And I don't get that. That's kind of a weird set of behaviors to suddenly kind of become the in thing for, I don't know, 10th graders or whatever.
Well, the vaping, you know, there were three big reasons why it was cool. Number one was because it's technologically cool. The kind of devices that are out there, you know, are for high-tech growing up adolescents, perfect. The second thing is they had all the flavors in the world to choose from.
Yeah.
So they were very attracted by flavors. And the third thing, as we talked earlier, is the nicotine content was so much higher than in a traditional cigarette that addiction could occur much more readily.
Wow. Well, Dr.
You know, in Vermont, unfortunately, when it comes to substance misuse in adolescents, there's a coupling of not only a higher use rate, but a decreased perception that the substance is harmful.
Dr. Can you stay with me for just a few minutes after the break? We got to go to some bottom of the hour news, but are you okay with that?
Yeah,
okay.
I'll hang on.
Great. I do appreciate it. Dr. Mark Levine, the health commissioner, state of Vermont, is my guest. We're talking about smart approaches, I guess, and harm reduction approaches to substance abuse, substance use, et cetera. So we'll be back and continue that in a couple of minutes.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, continuing into the last half hour of our program on this Tuesday morning. And Dr. Mark Levine, the health commissioner of the state of Vermont, has very kindly offered to stay with us a little bit after the break. We were originally scheduled to go until 10:30, but Dr. Levine, thanks very much for staying with us a little bit. I just wanted to check back in with you a little more on this topic of youth and trying to prevent youth from getting involved with substances in their teen years, especially because that seems to be kind of prime time for a lot of these problems to get started in an individual's life. And what is it that what are we missing when a young person decides that they're going to, you know, try heroin? They're at a friend's house or with a group of friends or whatever, and I mean, doesn't everybody know that this stuff is really going to lead you to bad places in life?
Well, one would think so. The good news is very, very, very few of our youth are trying heroin.
Uh-huh.
If that occurs, it's usually in someone who began smoking cigarettes, you know, in their early teens, went on to use alcohol and cannabis and perhaps stimulant drugs, and then eventually got to prescription opioids and then injecting heroin, maybe, you know, in their early 20s. So thank God that isn't happening. But the whole concept of perception of harm is a fascinating one. And I think, you know, perception of harm, if you're an adolescent, comes from whatever you know yourself from what you may have read, as well as what your society is saying about various things, and then what your own family and your parents are saying about things. So we spend a fair amount of time discussing on the website the actual power of the role model that a parent is for their children, because there's some very strong evidence that that plays a significant role. And we even have a website called parentupvt.org, parentupvt.org, which really helps support parents in talking with their children about substance use. And really having the kinds of conversations with them, whether it be about tobacco, whether it be about cannabis, that they never dreamed they were going to have with their kids, but that if you're a parent in this day and age, you really should be having. So they're very helpful, supportive videos and tips for parents that I urge them to look at.
What about the mass media? I mean, I think of movies, and a lot of times, you know, in movies, different substances kind of get different presentations almost. I think of, you know, movies that feature heroin addicts or whatever, generally not in a very glamorous light, or, you know, not in a very positive light. Whereas, you know, some of the movies I saw growing up, you know, the Cheech and Chong movies and so on and all that, marijuana was regarded as just kind of funny and goofy.
Absolutely. Although, you know, to credit the film industry a little bit, you know, if you watch movies that are older, almost everybody, including lots of women, are smoking.
Yeah.
Constantly. And nowadays, that's much less seen. And I think almost consciously avoided in a lot of what comes out of Hollywood, which has really been a step forward.
Yeah. I was just going to say that's a really good point. In fact, to the point now where sometimes you see something, there was a series very popular a few years ago, and it's still, I think, on Netflix, Mad Men, about the advertising industry back in the, you know, 1960s and so on. And it's kind of jarring when you see how many people are smoking on that show.
Exactly. I mean, that was cool at that time, and we didn't understand as much.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's not just movies. It's the internet in general. We talked before about the attraction of some of these vaping devices to our youth. You can find abundant YouTube videos of how to blow different designs and smoke rings when you're smoking or vaping that make it look quite cool, and that someone might want to emulate and see if they can do it even better.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's so much of that out there that a parent can't possibly control everything that their young person is going to see, but they can control what they hear at home, what they see at home, and the kind of messaging that they get at home.
For sure. And that is that is something that parents do have some responsibility there, I would think, to not set up examples necessarily that are going to be encouraging or, you know. In other words, if the parent, him or herself, is drinking a heck of a lot, I suppose there are, or smoking a lot of marijuana every day or whatever, there's going to be a greater chance that the young person in the household will just sort of absorb that behavioral pattern.
Right, and we don't want parents to underestimate how powerful they can be as an influence in their child's life.
Yeah, the kids never want to admit it, but... I suspect that is true, and frankly, as we know, in too many cases, that applies as well to negative behaviors as positive behaviors. Maybe better. I don't know why that would be, but you know, you think about behaviors that get passed on from generation to generation, and unfortunately, too many of them are negative behaviors, so that is certainly something to consider. Dr. Mark Levine, I think you have a really interesting project underway here at the health department with this website you have developed, Let's Talk Cannabis. Do you think that there might be other ones down the road, let's talk alcohol, or let's talk tobacco, or let's talk any other substance?
I'm not sure there'll be the let's talk thing, but the information about all those things is actually already on our website.
Yeah, okay.
And it's very accessible to any of your listeners. Just going to healthvermont.gov, lots of information on the things you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Even though they haven't been sort of highlighted as a new campaign, if you will.
Right. All right. Well, I thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's good chatting with you, and I wish you luck in this and all the other endeavors, which are quite a few. Your department is involved in trying to keep Vermonters healthy, so that's a good thing.
Thank you very much, Dave.
All righty. Hey, folks, I wanted to reach out to listeners out there and just mention that we're going to open the phone lines between now and the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show. You are welcome to call us at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. And I'm curious to know if listeners out there, let's say you've had young kids in your house, you know, teenagers. Have you felt constrained in your own consumption of alcohol or marijuana or anything else? Because you don't want your kids exposed to it. Is that something where maybe you curtail that stuff in your own life? Is that something where you try to hide it? I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing, but that's another strategy for sure. So I'm curious to know folks out there who have their own thoughts about how these things are conveyed from one generation to another. So more than welcome to call us here, 244-1777, 1-877-291-8255. Any topic really on your mind, that's a good one. Also, our conversation a little earlier with Bob Ney about all the impeachment dealings going on in Washington and how this thing might unfold in the coming weeks or maybe the coming months. We'll see. Depends on how long the Congress wants to wait for certain witnesses and documents to come over from the executive branch. Could take a while, but all of these things are unfolding in different realms that we deal with on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM, and really appreciate the participation of listeners out there who check in with us from time to time and offer your thoughts. So don't be shy out there. There is always ample stuff to talk about especially I sometimes joke that the current president is God's gift to talk radio hosts, because heaven knows the news flow out of the nation's capital in the last couple of years, really, since the campaign of 2016, has been just a torrent. It's been rather amazing. Anyway, Karen from Hardwick is on the line. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate hearing Bob Ney.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you like his return.
He's always interesting.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I like Bob a lot. He's obviously has some very interesting experience, including having served in Congress and then gone to federal prison. So he has seen life from two very different perspectives, one might say.
The other thing, when you have these people from nonprofits on, I wish you'd ask what their salaries are. It's public information. And I once asked the head of the Vermont Food Bank, and it seems he gets $120,000, and he's claiming that he feeds five meals for $3. It just seems wrong.
Well, I guess I'm going to give you a little bit of pushback on that, Karen. I don't know. I mean, these are big organizations. They involve a lot of workers, and certainly when you consider administering any large organization, folks in those jobs are working incredibly hard, typically long hours, and they are skilled at managing things. And if they weren't working for, say, the Vermont Food Bank or Capstone or one of the other sort of human services nonprofits around Vermont, they'd probably land in a job as a CEO of a utility or something, or somewhere else in private business, and they'd be making a lot more money. But
I bet you could get somebody to do it for less than $10,000 a month when they're claiming to be a charity. It just makes me angry.
Well, I appreciate that perspective, and I understand where you're coming from, but I also know that a lot of public jobs these days are paying you know, in the low six figures. That is just something that, you know, John Sayles has, just to use him, I don't mean to pick on him, but he has a lot of executive experience managing, you know, fairly high levels in state government agencies and this sort of thing.
And he's begging kids for cans of beans and their pocket change. Have to disagree with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Karen. Hey, we are fast approaching the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And I just want to tout once again, Giving Tuesday is a very important marker in our annual calendar. It's been going on for the last 8 years. It's a global thing. I guess countries all over the world are hosting events and talking it up today as a time to think about opening the wallet as you get ready to do your holiday shopping, Christmas shopping, and buying gifts for Hanukkah and other seasonal celebrations of this time of year. Don't forget about all the groups in your community that need your help, things like Capstone Community Action, the Good Samaritan Haven in Barrie, and of course the Vermont Food Bank. So folks, these are organizations that are really looking to take care of the community, and you can disagree with the salary levels of their top employees if you want, but they are doing good work and it should be supported. So there we have it. Hey, that is about it on the Tuesday morning edition of the Dave Graham Show here this December 3rd, 2019. Thanks, everybody, for joining in. I want to thank my guests for participating in the conversations here, as always, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. Talk to you all soon, folks.